got a sprain.
Welcome to another edition of Hey Doc. I'm Dr. Harold Lasky, medical director and physician at Southside Medical Center, right here in Jacksonville, Florida. I'm your host for the next half hour. With me today is my co-host and wife, Carmen Lasky, a certified EMT. Together, we hope that you will find the show informative, educational, as well as entertaining. One of the top trending questions on a well-known medical website concern coffee and its effect on the cardiovascular system. Apparently, a group of researchers used a large epidemiologic database to see if coffee drinking habits were actually driven by cardiovascular health rather than the other way around. The study used a strategy called Mendelian randomization, a term which you most likely have not been familiar with. It simply is a method of using something called measured variations in genes of known function to examine the causal effect of changeable exposure to disease in observational studies.
This method is often used to determine whether outside influences, in this case coffee drinking, are related to different gene variants that one might possess.
For example, it might be used to determine if high blood pressure and heart rate are determined by variations in genes. What now we are interested in are the results of this particular study that again uses this Mendelian randomization to look at persons with cardiovascular symptoms to see if they were more likely to drink less caffeinated coffee and to be non-habitual or decaffeinated coffee drinkers compared with those who did not report those particular related symptoms.
So, getting right to the results, the researchers found that human bodies regulate behavior in ways that may go unnoticed.
Not only that, the researchers said that this study, again using Mendelian hybridization, showed how other observational studies may create a false impression of health benefits linked to coffee consumption.
In other words, this study showed how some studies came up with false conclusions due to the red herring effect.
Now, that's a term I've often used on these shows. Now, don't go looking in your refrigerator for one. A red herring is something that misleads or distracts from a relevant or important question.
It may be either a logical fallacy or a literary device that leads readers or audiences toward a false conclusion.
In mystery fiction, it's often used to make the reader come to an incorrect conclusion before the author reveals the actual truth. In other words, the red herring is a seemingly plausible, though ultimately irrelevant, diversionary tactic.
Remember, I thought that the red herring may be intentional, as we showed it's used in mystery fiction, or unintentional, as it is not necessarily a conscious intent to mislead.
The reason the study was done was due to the fact that it appeared that persons with certain conditions would naturally avoid caffeinated coffee. So habitual coffee drinkers would then include fewer people who have those conditions, potentially causing a misleading health association.
Health associations were recently linked to coffee drinking. An imaging study found that regular consumption of coffee enhanced concentration and improved motor control and alertness by inducing changes in the brain.
Using the fMRI, the researchers found that connectivity in the body system of sensory nerves and nerve pathways that responds to changes at the surface or even inside, also called the somatosensory system, and the limbic system, which is the system that supports a variety of functions, and those include emotion, behavior, long-term memory, as well as the sense of smell called olfaction, which were reduced in regular coffee drinkers compared with non-coffee drinkers.
So now that we totally confused you, we'll try to quickly summarize what it all means.
The crux of the study was that regular intake of coffee by reducing the connectivity of particular brain networks at risk may be of relevance for attention and alertness with possible implications in learning and memory, and also for motor control.
Another coffee study found that regular caffeine consumption is tied to reduced gray matter volume in the brain. But this reduction is not due to caffeine's negative impact on sleep. The findings showed that the impact of caffeine on gray matter appears to be just temporary, with a rebound after a period of abstinence.
On the flip side, isn't there always a flip side? Taking caffeine or drinking strong coffee half an hour prior to aerobic exercise may increase fat burning, according to a new study.
The findings show that the effects of caffeine are greater if the exercise is done in the afternoon as opposed to the morning. Good to know. Compared with placebo, caffeine increased fat oxidation by over 10% in the morning, and listen to this, almost 30% in the afternoon. And caffeine also increased exercise intensity by 11% in the morning and just a little bit more, 13% in the afternoon.
Skin problems are on many people's minds these days. That is probably because psoriasis affects at least 100 million people worldwide, with plaque psoriasis being the most common form.
Although many different medication options are available for psoriasis, the type of treatment prescribed is chosen on the basis of severity and percentage of body surface area affected. So psoriasis is often defined as mild, moderate, moderate to severe, or severe disease. Moderate psoriasis involves between 3 and 10% of the skin surface, while severe psoriasis involves greater than 10%.
For moderate to severe psoriasis, the American Academy of Dermatology and National Psoriasis Foundation guidelines recommend systemic treatments, which include biologic agents.
And that is another term that is often misunderstood or not understood at all. A biologic drug, or biologic for short, is a product that is produced from living organisms or contains components of living organisms. Now, these may be derived from human, animal, or microorganisms by using biotechnology.
Some examples are certain vaccines, blood, blood components, cells, allergens, genes, tissues, and recombinant protein.
The development of several biologic agents over the past decade has dramatically changed the treatment of patients with psoriasis. Biologic agents can be engineered antibodies and proteins that block the specific chemicals or their receptors that mediate the inflammation that's seen with psoriasis. Now, so far, 11 biologic agents are approved by the U.S. Food and Drug Administration, you know, the FDA, and they're approved for psoriasis. Now, certain ones, which we will name later, all ending in the syllable UMAB, have a superior response rate compared with other treatments. But right now, it is difficult to determine which of the five UMABs is best for a particular patient.
When a physician is said to determine which, if any, of the biologic to use in the treatment of the patient, the first thing that the physician must do is to see what other medications the patient is taking and what other medical problems the patient has, especially if there is also joint pain.
For example, plaque psoriasis and other forms of skin psoriasis typically precede the onset of psoriatic arthritis, with about one quarter of those patients will have concurrent psoriatic arthritis.
In that case, where there is both psoriasis and psoriatic arthritis, the doctor may choose one of the biologics that treats both diseases.
When treating patients who have psoriasis and psoriatic arthritis, some physicians choose biologics approved to treat both of these conditions. Now we'll name them. Adalimumab, infliximab, certolizumab, Begol, etanercept, ezekizumab, secukinumab, ustekinumab, and finally, guselkumab. However, some treatments approved only for plaque psoriasis could also be effective in treating symptoms of the arthritis. Then doctors must consider the side effects of the treatments, such as infection.
According to the psoriasis longitudinal assessment and registry, the rate of serious infections in the biologics does not appear to be higher than that seen in patients not on the systemic treatments. One problem is often the cost of the treatment to the patients.
Doctors may end up prescribing office-administered medications as first-line treatment for Medicare patients without Part D coverage. In regard to patients on Medicare, most biologics are typically covered under Part D plans, which not all patients have. However, biologics that are approved only for administration by a healthcare provider may be covered under Medicare Part B.
And finally, adherence can be an issue, even in patients taking injectable treatments. As is the case with many chronic conditions, treatment adherence can prove challenging in patients with plaque psoriasis, particularly those with severe disease.
This is a great time to tell you about Southside Medical Center. Hello, I'm Dr. Harold Lasky. I have been the medical director and physician at Southside Medical Center for the past 34 years. We're located at 3604 Southside Boulevard, just two blocks south of the Beach Boulevard intersection between the Tulsa Welding School and the old Pottsburg Post Office. We will treat your pains, sprains, and strains.
We are proud to welcome to Southside Medical Center Dr. Susan Pollan, MD, a board-certified pain specialist.
Our practice emphasizes chronic pain management as well as anti-aging medicine. We also have an office-based substance treatment program for those who need it. Southside Medical Center is open 10 a.m. to 5 p.m. Monday through Friday. If you would like to make an appointment or ask any questions about Southside Medical Center, please call us at 641-4411. That's 641-4411. Southside Medical Center, where your health is our primary care.
Welcome back to the Hey Doc Show. Luckily, there is a new biologic called bimekizumab, and it's undergoing trials right now. It has been shown to have particularly good results in treating plaque psoriasis and is currently pending FDA approval. There are 34.2 million people, or just over 10% of the U.S. population, with diabetes, and 88 million people aged 18 or older having prediabetes. That's about 34.5% of the adult U.S. population.
And an additional 24.2 million people aged 65 years or older having prediabetes. Many of you now listening either suffer from the disease or have family members and friends that do.
The cause of type 1 diabetes is the inability for insulin-secreting pancreatic cells to produce insulin in response to elevated blood sugar levels. Finally, insulin-secreting beta cells injected into mice can reverse type 1 diabetes. The main problem has been that introducing these cells into humans without the body's natural immune response has been a major obstacle in curing diabetes.
Now it appears that researchers have developed an apparently safe functional device for delivery of the beta cells.
Researchers at the Washington University School of Medicine in St. Louis, Missouri, have developed a tiny implant that successfully delivers insulin-secreting cells into mice with diabetes without the need for immunosuppressive drug treatment.
The human body uses the autoimmune response to protect itself from foreign invaders, including bacteria, viruses, fungi, and even other animal cells. The cells called beta cells are unique cells in the pancreas that produce, stores, and release insulin.
Dr. Jeffrey Millman is one of the researchers that had previously participated in research that led to a method to make cells that can give rise to several different cell types called pluripotent stem cells and then grow those cells into insulin-secreting beta cells. They can take a person's skin, or even fat cells for that matter, and make them into stem cells in the lab, and then grow those stem cells into the insulin-secreting beta cells.
The problem lies in the fact that in those patients with type 1 diabetes, their immune system attacks those insulin-secreting cells and destroys them.
When the newly created cells are introduced, they can then re-trigger the autoimmune disease process that originally destroyed the beta cells in the first place. Yes, there are drugs available that suppress the immune system. The problem here is that using these drugs makes patients vulnerable to infections. So for years, the scientists have tried several implants with, well, varying levels of success.
The device has to have small enough openings to prevent the invasion of immune cells while being large enough to take in nutrients and oxygen and release the insulin.
So the researchers developed a device with nanofiber integrated cell encapsulation, or NICE, N-I-C-E, for short. First, the NICE device is implanted with stem cell-derived insulin-secreting beta cells. Then the device is inserted into the abdomen of the mice with chemically induced diabetes. Within 1 week of the implantation of the NICE device, the diabetes was reversed.
The cells in the implants continue to secrete insulin, control blood sugar, and reverse diabetes in the treated mice for up to 200 days with no drugs administered to suppress their immune systems.
So how big is this device? Well, it's about the width of a few strands of hair. It's microporous with openings that are so small that other cells cannot squeeze through, so the insulin-secreting cells consequently can't be destroyed by immune cells, which just happen to be larger than the openings. They therefore have what is called the Goldilocks zone, where the cells could feel just right inside the device and remain healthy and functional, releasing insulin in response to blood sugar levels.
The implants floated freely inside the mice, and when they removed them after about 6 months, the insulin-secreted cells inside the implant still were functioning.
So now is a good time to address all of you with diabetes or with family members who have diabetes. You need to balance what you eat and drink with your insulin medication to keep your blood glucose in a good range. Managing blood glucose levels helps prevent the short and long-term effects of both high and low blood sugars. So let's start talking about what a healthy diabetic diet can include. First of all, eggs, non-starchy vegetables, and whole grains.
Since problems can occur if there is hypoglycemia, meaning low blood sugar, or hyperglycemia, which means high sugar, the diabetic must use the right type and amount of injectable insulin and eat regular meals and snacks to maintain the blood sugar level and all other necessary nutrients for your body.
Diabetics should also attempt to maintain a moderate weight and keep their cholesterol and blood pressure within target ranges. Is there a standard diabetic diet? Well, that would be too easy. There's no standard diet for type 1 diabetes, and the American Diabetes Association reports that ideal macronutrient percentages, well, they vary among individuals. But there are guidelines to maintain that perfect balance.
First, you should include protein in every meal. This can help balance blood sugar. Good choices are lean meat and poultry, fish, eggs, beans, and lentils, tofu, nuts, and seeds, as well as low-fat dairy foods.
Next, you should add plenty of non-starchy vegetables, such as lettuce, kale, cabbage, bok choy, spinach, watercress, bell peppers, zucchini, eggplant, green beans, mushrooms, broccoli, and cauliflower. Now, try to limit the starchy vegetables, such as potatoes, pumpkin, and corn, because they contain more sugar.
Remember that we suggested nuts, seeds, beans, and legumes? They can slow down the release of sugar into the blood. They are also a source of protein.
Excellent choices of nuts include walnuts, Brazil nuts, almonds, and hazelnuts. Also healthy are chia, hemp, pumpkin, and sunflower seeds. And don't forget the beans, the lentils, and the garbanzos. Whole grains are better than refined grains and are a good source of carbohydrates. And their fiber content means that they have a better effect on blood sugar than refined grains. However, it is advisable to be careful with portion size and monitor the effects of these foods.
The whole grain foods include brown rice, whole wheat bread, whole grain pasta, buckwheat, quinoa, and millet.
But you should also include some of the healthful fats to feel fuller, and you should avoid eating too many carbohydrates. You may be wondering just what are the healthful fats. Well, these include avocados, olives, and olive oil, nuts and seeds, and oily fish, such as salmon, tuna, and mackerel. And don't forget to stay hydrated. In these hot summer days, it's even more important to watch your hydration than the rest of the year.
Less water in the body means a higher blood sugar concentration, so it is crucial for someone with type 1 diabetes to stay hydrated.
Water is the best choice for hydration, but people also try adding lemons, slices, you know, all the citric slices, mint to create flavored water, or even drinking herbal teas. And finally, we get to the foods you should really attempt to avoid, such as those with added sugars, refined grains such as white bread, pasta and rice, processed foods, sugary breakfast cereals, sweet treats such as cakes, biscuits, pastries, and candies, soda, even diet soda, and other sugary drinks, juice drinks, as well as fried foods, and foods high in saturated and trans fats. These are the no-no foods. Of course, staying away from alcoholic beverages is important as well.
You should take the time to learn some carbohydrate counting as well as using the glycemic index and glycemic load to help measure the amount of sugar in food and how much they will raise the blood sugar level. All of us like snacks and diabetics are no different, so I am going to give you a list of snacks that should aim to balance carbohydrates with protein or fat. The helpful snack idea include hummus and oat cakes, chocolate protein balls made with oats, nut butter, cocoa powder, and a diabetic-friendly sweetener such as stevia, celery sticks, and nut butter. Also, you can include a boiled egg. You can also go to any smoothie store and ask for a protein smoothie with no added sweetener. Always remember that eating a lower sugar fruit together with a protein source may help balance blood glucose more than eating the fruit on its own. For example, a good idea is to eat berries with natural yogurt.
All of us like snacks, and diabetics are no different. Now, if we went too fast for you, or you just want to hear that list again, just go to radiopodcastcentral.com/hey-doc-podcasts and click on the link to today's show. It will appear on the list a week after the show airs. Now, as a matter of fact, you can listen to all of our previous shows by using that link. Again, it's radiopodcastcentral.com/hey-doc-podcast. ¿Por qué me miras así? Mientras me visto sin ti. Recuerda bien este cuerpo que fue tuyo a placer. I'd like you, our listeners, to know that I am one of several physicians right here in the Jacksonville area that has received the certification to recommend medical marijuana to those patients with certain qualifying diagnoses. For more information, you can call our office at 641-4411. We have also set up a special website at CompassionateCareJax.com, where you can get a whole lot more information on medical marijuana. We've come to the end of another Hey Doc show.
So, from all of us here at Southside Medical Center, have a happy and healthy weekend. Goodbye.